Hello, Lynn Malcolm with you. Welcome to our Big Ideas Summer of Science on ABC Radio National. Over the next 5 weeks at this time, we'll bring you some lively public discussions that have been held across the country during 2010. Panels of scientists, together with enthusiastic, sometimes rowdy audiences, ask fascinating and often contentious questions. Is modern man evolution's greatest mistake? Would the planet be better off without us? Is there an ultimate theory that explains everything? And are we really alone in the universe? Today, let's begin small, in fact, minuscule, with nanotechnology. This Cafe Scientific Forum, like some nanotech in your shopping trolley, was recorded at Tilly Devine's Bar in Canberra last year. Your host is Dr. Paul Willis from ABC TV's Catalyst program.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Cafe Scientific at Tilly's in Canberra. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, nanotechnology. You've heard the word, but do you know the message? Do you know how nanotechnology is already changing your lives and what the potential is in the future? And what the threats are and what the legislation ought to be, the regulation. It's a complex field, ladies and gentlemen. That's why we've assembled a group of four eminent people to talk about the subject of nanotechnology tonight. Please would you welcome to the stage Dr. Mike Biersick. He's from the Quantum Control Laboratory at the University of Sydney, and I didn't think you could control quantum matters, but we'll have to discuss that a little later, Mike. From the ANU School of Physics, Professor Jim Williams. From the Faculty of Law at the University of New South Wales, Dr. Lyria Bennett-Moses. And also from the ANU, this time the Department of Applied Mathematics, Associate Professor Tim Sendon. Let's meet these people in a little more detail. Tim, tell me a little bit about yourself and your work at the ANU in nanotechnology.
Well, Paul, I'm a chemist, actually, a colloid chemist, and we'll hear more about colloids later on. I've worked with nanotech, as it's now called, for 20-odd years, and I've worked in the area of atomic force microscopy, which is a device for feeling molecules, basically, and feel the texture of atomic surfaces. I've worked with nanoparticles in the use of medical diagnosis, and really just applying colloids to things like watching paint dry, even.
So, nanotechnology, we're talking about 1/1,000,000th of a millimetre.
Yeah, so it's a broad church, nanotechnology. You might say that's everything from a nanometer or even slightly less, atomic scale, all the way up to just on a micron. But people do flex those boundaries a little bit when they talk about nanotechnology.
Let's move on to Mike. Now, you are at the University of Sydney. As we mentioned, the Quantum Control Laboratory. You are working on incredibly small scales. Tell us about your work.
So my work at the University of Sydney is primarily focused on trapping and controlling individual atoms. We use lasers to cool the atoms, we use electromagnetic fields to contain them, and then we can manipulate the quantum mechanical states of those particles. But I also have a background in nanoelectronics, and there's a lot of tie-in between the two fields. But I do have to start off by correcting you, because nanotechnology does not pertain to 1/1,000,000th of a millimeter, as you said, but 1/1,000,000th of a meter.
1/1,000,000th.
1/1,000,000th of 1 millimeter or 1/1,000,000th of a meter.
Okay, right. I stand corrected. But also on that point about quantum control laboratory, I mean, does this mean you've overcome Heisenberg's uncertainty principle? I mean, how can you control stuff at the quantum level?
We are not defying the laws of physics. Everything we're doing is consistent with reality. It just happens that...
That's reassuring.
I like to think so. I feel better about myself in the morning. We can do some really interesting things controlling degrees of freedom that can only be described by quantum mechanics. Heisenberg's uncertainty is always there. We're always bound by that. But we still can control matter on the level of single quanta, single atoms.
And I understand that Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is easily stated as, Dr. Heisenberg, are you or are you not building a bomb for Hitler? And the answer is, it depends on who's asking. Is that right?
As far as I know.
Okay, let's move on to Jim. What are you doing at the ANU with nanoparticles?
Well, Paul, I'm a physicist. I was trying to think when you were asking the others what they were. What I do sits at the boundary of physics and engineering and material science. So I'm one of those three. And what I've been doing with some scientific colleagues at the ANU recently is pressing down on materials, silicon materials, with a very sharp diamond tip and changing the properties of that material at the nanoscale. And you can do very interesting things like write electrically conducting or insulating lines on that material. And you could conceive of applications for that in things like smart cards, more information, cards that you can't reproduce easily unless you have a very sharp diamond tip. So that's the type of research.
So you're squashing really, really tiny things to even smaller things?
Well, not so much squashing, but you're pressing down on the material with a harder tip that now changes that material. It squashes it and it changes it into a new crystal structure, which you can do under pressure, but it's very difficult to do any other way. And that different structure has different properties, and that's what's attractive.
And Liria, you look more at the laws and regulations surrounding nanotechnology, is that right?
Yes, and not just nanotechnology. So I look generally at legal issues that arise in the context of technological change, but that includes issues surrounding how one goes about regulating something like nanotechnology.
As we unroll the discussions tonight, that area of the question of regulation nanotechnology is far more complicated. There's mountains and there's valleys there that most people would not conceive.
Well, that's what I hope will come out of the evening.
We thought that one way of being able to get across nanotechnology in everyone's life is we have, in fact, a range of products here which are already available and have nanotechnology incorporated in them in one way or another. And my beautiful assistant here, Abigail, she went down the supermarket this afternoon and got a variety of products with nanomaterials in them. Now, foam condoms with nanometer silver in them. Can somebody explain to me what exactly I've got in my hand here? Does anybody know about foam condoms?
Thankfully, I don't.
You don't? Then what's the advertising claim there about nanometer silver? There are actually products out there that are condoms that contain nanometer silver. What is the nanometer silver doing in a condom?
I think I'll hazard a guess. Silver's been an agent we've used as an antibacterial surface for a long, long time, and that's why silver knives and forks were around for many hundreds of years. But nanoparticle silver's been used in all sorts of products now, from refrigerators to, well, condoms, I guess. Now it's news to me too. And the idea there is that they're antibacterial.
Right. That doesn't exactly fill me with confidence in using this particular product. I gather also that underwear is being produced with nanosilver in it. Is that correct?
It wouldn't surprise me, Paul.
And the purpose is just to keep bacteria down. Are we talking about interpersonal transmission of bacteria, or are we talking about keeping smells down, because most human body odour is, in fact, from bacteria?
I imagine it's all those things combined. The alternative would be wear chainmail underwear made out of silver, and we'd do the same thing, but it would be expensive and heavy. By making something...
And not particularly sexually attractive, I wouldn't think.
Well, it depends on your bent. The thing about nanosilver, in fact, we'll hear more about this evening, is that making something a nanoparticulate means you can do it cheaply and you can cover the same range of properties. In fact, sometimes improved properties.
Well, going back to our shopping basket, and Tim, two products for you. It may be a surprise to you, ladies and gentlemen, but Tim is not the only person in the world who would describe milk, such as this standard carton of milk I have in my hand, as a nanoproduct. And a Gore-Tex jacket. There must have been some supermarket you went to this afternoon, babe, that actually dispenses silver condoms, milk and Gore-Tex jackets. How are milk and Gore-Tex jackets nanoproducts?
Okay, so this is... It's not tongue-in-cheek at all. Milk is really what defines us as mammals, and we've been making milk probably, at best guesses, probably 120 million years or so. Milk is a great way of getting minerals and fat into a young child. So one of the components of milk, of course, is calcium. It's there as calcium phosphate, and that's preciously pretty much insoluble in water. So the question is, how do you get the rich calcium into your baby? If you divide it finely enough and bind it up with some proteins, then it can be dispersed as a colloid in this case, as a nanoparticle, and that means that the baby can ingest effectively a great mass of solid, insoluble material.
And so nanotechnology has been used by nature for millions of years.
Certainly in this form, yeah. And I think scientists often adapt what they see in nature. And really, that's the basis of my field of chemistry, is to look at what's happened in nature. Muddy rivers are another example of this sort of stabilisation of nanoparticles. But not tongue-in-cheek at all, I wanted to say that, in fact, we've been with nanotechnology for so long, it's so commonplace, sometimes we overlook it. And that's a safe product for many people.
And how is Gore-Tex a nano product?
Well, the point here is that we'll talk often about making matter, dividing it finer and finer, to confer new and improved properties as we shrink that matter down. Sometimes it's not the matter we want to divide down, it's the space between the matter. So Gore-Tex is a great example. It's Teflon, and those of us who have Teflon fry pans at home know that, of course, water doesn't wet Teflon. Now, Mr. Gore had an idea that if he finely divided Gore-Tex, he'd make little air spaces that would allow vapour of water to pass, but not liquid water.
Okay. Let's move along. So nanotechnology really has been with us for millions of years and has been exploited by industry for decades now in things like Gore-Tex. Mike, you actually have your item from the shopping basket already in front of you. We have a picture here blown up of it, ladies and gentlemen. This is a microprocessor. A microprocessor, in fact, the one you have is the original Pentium.
That's correct. This is the original Pentium from 1992. That is a photograph from Intel, courtesy of them, so thanks. I'm holding it up. It's about a square centimeter. It's inside a chip carrier. It's connected via electrodes, just small metal wires. This is the microprocessor that you find in your laptop. Well, this one would be from 20 years ago. But it's the kind of microprocessor that forms the basis of almost everything that you use on a daily basis, from a smartphone to a desktop or a laptop, to your car. And while this is not what we would traditionally consider nanotechnology in terms of the sexiness of the field, it is in fact nanotechnology by all of the formal official definitions. And the formal definitions pertain to having active components or devices with a single dimension on the scale of tens or hundreds of nanometers or less. So with that in mind, nanotechnology comes into play in the way we build these devices. These are chips of silicon where we fabricate, we pattern very small electrodes and active regions that use the properties of the base material. This is a semiconductor, silicon, in order to form electronic devices that we'll use for computation. Now, this kind of device has in it very thin layers of insulator, layers in the original Pentium that were about 5 nanometers thick. It also has an electronic device called a transistor, many of them, in fact. The transistor has a length, in this case, of about 800 nanometers. Now, if you look at more modern processors, those dimensions have gotten considerably smaller. And this is all because of the fact that nanofabrication techniques have improved so dramatically based on the, I guess you could call it the processor race, all these different companies competing against each other to pack more power for computation into the same kind of area. In modern processors, the oxide thicknesses that are used as insulators are on the scale of 1 nanometer. So you have 1 nanometer thick insulator that is used in the electronic device. And then you also have an active device region in terms of the length of the transistor that's only 45 nanometers. And in just about a year and a half, Intel is supposed to release a new generation where the active device region is only 22 nanometers in length. This is really pretty astounding. This is really, really small. You're packing enormous amounts of processing hardware into a really small area. Paul showed a picture. The picture was the size of an A4 sheet. But again, I'll remind you that the chip itself is only about a square centimeter. And only a couple years ago, Intel was able, with their what was called the Itanium processor, to put 1 billion transistors on a single chip that was roughly a square centimeter in size.
So you can build a computer without nanotechnology, but a laptop requires a B-double to move it around.
You can do a lot of things without nanotechnology. It just happens that in this particular case, nanotechnology is kind of implicit in the device scaling that we use in order to realize the kind of computational power we want. Now, this is just what we had 20 years ago. I talked about what we have today. the really new and exciting things are coming in the next 10, 20, 50 years, again, pertaining to electronics, nanoelectronics in particular, for computation. So first, there's the idea of what comes next. We keep making these things smaller. We can continue to do that using some new kinds of nanofabrication techniques, techniques that are called bottom-up, where you actually can grow a nanostructure and then contact it electrically and get many more active devices in the same area. That's what you might call the next generation. The next generation looks at what happens when you make things so small that the physical behavior is totally different than the active devices that we use daily. So these transistors, when they get so small, aren't going to behave like transistors anymore. That's where quantum mechanics takes over. That's kind of the field that I tend to work in. So there's a very exciting prospect for the realization of what's called quantum computation as a long-term goal, where you can make very small devices, for instance, that trap and manipulate single electrons in semiconductor materials, and we can use them to do computation in a fundamentally new way.
All right, let's move along, ladies and gentlemen, back to the shopping baskets. And for Jim, we have a tennis racket, we have optic fibers, and we have an iPhone. So where is the nanotechnology in those three items there, Jim?
What's the connection between these three items, the iPhone, the optical fiber, and the tennis racket? Well, what I'm going to say about the iPhone fits in very well with what Mike has just told you. The iPhone, phones that had all this information in it, only became possible when the dimensions of the devices that hold that information went below a micron into the nano realm. That gave us the power to do all the wonderful things we can do on the latest iPhones or iPads that we have now. So it's the size of the devices that are in the chips in here that are down in the nano dimensions that allow us to have that capacity. And that's getting smaller and smaller. But as Mike indicated, when it gets very small, we get down to the nanoparticle size dimensions that Tim mentioned, and things start to change. And this is what I wanted to say. When you get down to nano, real nano, the properties of the silicon chip changes. And this is a real challenge for the technologists. What happens when you get down there? Well, there's some people, and they're quantum people like Mike, that have sort of said, well, this opens up a new realm of the very small regions that you're making in these things. You can control them in a very different way in what can be called a quantum computer, which actually works a bit like your brain. Your brain is interconnected in a way that the bits of information in a normal computer are not connected. They're isolated bits that can't talk to each other. But in your brain and in a quantum computer, the bits of information are actually connected and can talk to each other. And the power there is going to be enormous, but it's going to be a long time before we can see that. But phones, some of them have and some of them will have in the future, a whole range of other nano things in it, the casing that these things fit in, the laminations over the screen and things have nanoparticles in. And one area that's been talked about is to make them light, much lighter. You need carbon fiber or carbon nanotube type frames of this. They don't exist now, but they may. The carbon nanotubes need to get cheaper to do that. That brings me to the tennis racket. Now, there are two parts of a tennis racket that have, the very latest tennis rackets have nanoparticles in, and these are called carbon nanotubes, and they're made into an epoxy for the frame, but they're quite expensive. Roger Federer and Leighton Hewitt and Rafael Nadal can afford them at the moment. This is not a carbon nanotube tennis racket, I might tell you, but also the strings. And why is that? Well, carbon nanotubes have very interesting mechanical properties. They are much harder, but they also bend much more. And when you hit a tennis ball, you know that you really need that sort of property in the tennis racket. Golf balls now, the latest, more expensive golf balls, have nanotubes actually embedded in them to give them that strength but flexibility or elasticity that you can hit them a long way. And that brings me to the optical fiber. The iPhone is a communication device, but we've heard a lot about broadband, and we'll hear a continuing amount about broadband into the future. We all want more speed coming to our home. And the interesting feature of broadband is that optical fiber is the main way that that can be transformed. And optical fibres are the outer casing of the fibre is about the diameter of a hair on your head, but the inner core is a micron or less than a micron. There's nothing nano about that. But these days, into the fibre itself, this very small, thin wire, they're introducing materials or nanoparticles to change the properties of light, and also holy fibres, that is, holes of nano dimensions through this fibre. And when you do that, the properties of light interacting with this material change dramatically, and you do wonderful things. Put much more information down the fibre, for example. You can change one colour of light to another, so you can change the information by switching it, so wonderful things can happen.
That touches on two stories I've covered on Catalyst. One is Tanya Munro's work in South Australia, where she's been putting these holes lengthways down an optic fibre. I was foolish enough to think she drilled them. And in fact, what they do is you create a big piece of optic fibre, a couple of centimetres in diameter with the holes in it, and then you draw it out until it's thin enough that the holes are nanometer dimensions. But also a team at Sydney University, they're working in collaboration with ANU, who've developed a photonic chip, and this allows some processing of optic signals and will speed up the internet a thousandfold or some?
Absolutely, Paul.
Jim Williams from the Australian National University on our Cafe Scientific panel with Tim Senden, also from the ANU, and Mike Biersick from the Quantum Control Centre at the University of Sydney. You're listening to our Big Ideas Summer of Science on ABC Radio National. I'm Lynne Malcolm, and we're analysing the nanotechnology in your shopping trolley. It's a Cafe Scientific forum recorded during Science Week at Tilly Devine's Bar in Canberra. Now, back to host Paul Willis with his question for the other panellist, Lyria Bennett-Moses.
Lyria, you have a wonderful German product by the name of Magic Nano Glass and Ceramic. And this wonderful product actually contains no nanoparticles, but was at the centre of a controversy.
That's right. There's always been this fear, not so much obviously of the iPhones and tennis rackets, but of consumer products that contain actual nanomaterials. And what that is materials where the particle size is at the nanometer scale. And this was a German product that was called Magic Nano, and the idea was it would be a brilliant glass ceramics sealant. What happened was that about 100 people ended up with respiratory symptoms and got very sick, and of course the product was withdrawn. And the reaction initially was, oh my goodness, it's happened, the nanotechnology disaster. You know, we have to take it off the shelves, we have to have a moratorium on all nanotechnology, of course, without necessarily thinking about the tennis rackets or the milk. We have to have a moratorium because, you know, this stuff is dangerous. It turned out that, in fact, Magic Nano was not a nanotechnology product. In other words, there were no nanomaterials in the product. The reason I chose this instead of an actual nanotechnology product is just, I suppose, to start thinking about the idea of what is it that we want to regulate. So do we want to regulate some category called nanotechnology, or do we want to regulate against a certain level of risk in certain contexts, and what might that be?
And to move that idea along, we have some moisturiser and sunscreen. And sunscreen moisturisers, a number of cosmetics now contain nanoparticles. A number of paints contain nanoparticles, usually zinc or titanium oxide. Why?
Why do they contain nanoparticles? Well, if you take sunscreen as an example, so you can put sunscreen on and traditional sunscreen gives you that pasty white colour, but the chemicals do protect you from the sun. When those same particles, so zinc oxide, for example, is put into a nano form, so when you bring the particle size down, what you get is the same effect in terms of the sunscreen properties, but it doesn't go on white and pasty. Instead, it goes on more or less clear, which is obviously attractive to consumers.
But there's been a call for regulation. If there's a cutting edge of the legislation and regulation debate, it's concerning cosmetics in particular, isn't it?
That's right. So in Europe, for example, now they have specific regulations for nanomaterials in cosmetics. And the concerns are essentially the lack of testing. So whether when you put the nanomaterials on, it will go through the skin, and if the particles do go through the skin, what the effect of that might be. And they've done studies that show that it doesn't go through healthy skin. So if I was to put it right there, we'd know from studies that that's safe. But the studies have not tried enough different types of skin. So, for example, if you're older and your skin is thinner, or if you have a cuts and you're just rubbing sunscreen on and there are cuts, the question is, have there been enough studies to cover those sorts of problems? Do we know that the sunscreens are safe in that context? And then the question has come up, do we need regulation for nanomaterials? And my question is, what do we need regulation for?
Now, Leary has raised a very important question, the controversial side of nanotechnology, about regulation and the fact that you can't have one size fits all because nanotechnology, as we've just demonstrated, is so diverse. But as guys working in the various fields of nanotechnology, how do you feel about the idea of there being regulations on the sorts of products that you're working with and that may come out of your research? Mike, would you like to go first?
Sure. So I am of the opinion that for consumer products in particular, there may be a need for regulation of nanomaterials. But I would say and qualify that it shouldn't be a regulation based on the fact that there are nanomaterials at all. It's more that there are chemicals that you're putting on your skin, and you can make this a much broader kind of regulatory framework.
There are laws currently in place for chemical regulation.
Sure.
Are they good enough?
I'm not an expert on chemical safety. I'm also not a legal expert. But for instance, it's well known in that in the United States, you can look at safe water laws, drinking water laws. And in those drinking water laws, there is a very well-defined list of things that can't appear in your water above a certain concentration. But that list is not infinite, right? There's a whole slew of things that appear in your water all the time that just don't get tested for, in particular, runoffs from pesticides, runoffs from pharmaceuticals, right? We all excrete pharmaceuticals. You take a pill, you pee it out, and all that gets into the water supply. None of that is regulated. You can drink as much water as you want. There's no limit on how much of any particular pharmaceutical product can appear in your water supply. Now, I wanted to come back to nanotechnology for just a second and try and emphasize this point that nanotechnology is not one thing. I think we've shown it pretty reasonably convincingly. But I have a friend who tells a story that really, I think, captures this. And this is to say, you know, people claim nanotechnology is this one thing. We need to regulate nanotechnology, nanomaterials. Nanotechnology as a concept is nonsense. It doesn't make any sense to define something just by a size scale. If one did that, we could say that you can have a new class of technology that we call meter technology. And meter technology includes glassware, it includes tables, it includes trash bins, airplanes, and meat. Do you think you should have the same kind of regulation for your trash bin as you have for the meat products you consume? I think the answer is clearly no, it's nonsense. That being said, anytime you have a new product, a new chemical that's being added into a consumer product, there should be a safety concern raised.
The problems with existing laws fall into various kinds of categories, and there's many people who've written about this, and the problems exist not only in Australia but in other countries, Europe, America, and so forth. So the types of problems that arise, one is the problem of the notion of existing chemical. So it makes sense when you regulate something that you say, okay, we know this chemical is safe. You can manufacture this one. It's already been tested. Don't worry about that one. If you're coming up with something new, we want to know about it. The difficulty with nanotechnology is the way those regulations have been drafted. In other words, is a nano version of a macro chemical new? In other words, if silver is accepted and we can have silver and we don't have regulation of silver, right? If you come up with nano silver in Band-Aids or something else for the microbial properties that we've talked about, do we want to have extra questions asked at that stage? And the way the laws tend to be drafted is that no, we're not asking those questions, and those things can come straight out. So the same thing with zinc oxides and so forth. We've had zinc oxide for a long time. We don't re-question it at the nanoform, and that's a problem. Other problems are in a lot of chemical regulation, industrial chemical regulation and so forth, and water pollution legislation and everything else, is everything is done on mass or volume. So you have threshold. If you're manufacturing more than a ton of something, we want to know about it. If it's less than a ton, don't tell us, we don't really care. Now, that's fine for most stuff. One of the problems with nanomaterials is they can be more reactive in smaller quantities, or they can have properties in smaller quantities that we'd want to know about. So the sort of measures, the sort of ton idea, where you don't often get to in nanomaterials, you're not often doing it in that type of quantity, then means that the laws don't kick in, if you like.
The argument has been raised, though, that, for instance, in the case of zinc oxide, that it has been tested at the nanoscale, because all of the old processes of making zinc oxide to put in sunscreens meant that part of the zinc oxide going into those old sunscreens was at the nanoscale. And so the tests on the old sunscreens was a test on nano zinc. So therefore, we don't need to retest it all over again just because we're producing a more pure nano form of zinc. Is that a valid argument?
In fact, if you look at something like sunscreens, it hasn't been an area that has been highly regulated at all. So there hasn't been a lot of cosmetic regulation. If certain kinds of claims you'd make came with certain kinds of... So you started making therapeutic claims, for example, you'd have to sort of verify them and so forth. But generally speaking, there's a lot of products that weren't really regulated at all. And the questions are coming up more now that there are nano versions of them. When we look at the nano versions, to what extent can we rely on the sort of mixed versions to draw conclusions? That's a question, in a sense, for the scientists. My point is that the solution is not necessarily to say, okay, what we therefore need is nanotechnology regulation or even necessarily nanomaterial regulation. We just need to think more carefully about how our regulations are designed and drafted.
Jim?
I think that there's a case for the fact that nanotechnology has come along to look at our existing regulations in their own right, but also in the nature of nanotechnology, and does this add anything to that? And I was also going to say that in manufacturing nanoproducts, like the tennis racket, for example, or like something else, you go through a process there where the final product is quite safe and no different to our existing products, but in the workplace it mightn't be. What is the way you make carbon nanoparticles? Do they get out into the atmosphere? So there's workplace regulation now that we need to look at. But again, it's really augmenting what you could argue should have been there in the past.
Because there have been studies on rats that show that carbon nanotubes can cause mesothelioma and asbestos-like diseases.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Tim, do you think that we've rolled out various nanotechnologies into the marketplace too early?
Yes and no. I mean, there's a lot of points to make from the discussion just already. I think the nice thing about zinc oxide, it is so soluble, and one thing you have to ask yourself about these nanoparticles is, what are their fate in the biological system? Titanium dioxide, which is the alternative, is quite insoluble in water, but zinc oxide, for example, is readily uptaken by the body and dissolved and excreted. You then have to look at, does it transmit through the epidermis into the bloodstream so quickly that you get a pulse of zinc? Is that toxic? And these questions are being looked at and studied in straight in the chemical toxicity sense. They've lost their nanotech in sense once they've become into the blood system. The carbon fibre one's interesting because the nanotubes, yes, they do cause granulomas and other aberrant cell growth, but that's because they're long fibres. And it's a little bit like asbestos in that case. It's the shape of the fibre that counts. But if you go to a round particle, diesel exhaust, for example, that's another one of these nanoparticles. In fact, any internal combustion output produces nanoparticles of carbon. It's not the carbon itself that's a hazard. It doesn't cause aberrant cell growth. It's the partially burnt film of fuel that's around those particles that is the toxic element. So you do have to be careful when you consider both the chemistry and the particle size. In fact, you'd need the tools of nanoscience to study these materials first. And I think that has to inform the regulation that comes about.
Because earlier you guys were saying if there's going to be regulation of nanoparticles, they should start with diesel smoke.
Indeed. That was Mike's point over a beer. And it's simply that if we look at the prevalence of nanoparticles in our environment, you know, human-generated nanoparticles, then, of course, diesel smoke and petrol smoke, of course, is the most prevalent. And you start there. That's the first point.
There's another major source that's human-made in this kind of sense, and that's smoke from forest fires or smoke from burning wood in your fireplace. It contains a lot of nanoparticles that have been shown in toxicology studies to cause aberrant cell growth and other diseases. This is, unfortunately, a really complicated problem. First of all, because a lot of these particles have been in nature. When you go to the beach, you breathe in more nanoparticles from silica, that's the silicon dioxide, the sand, than you probably get by putting sunscreen on. I don't know the numbers, but you know, you get exposed to a lot. Similarly, if there's a sandstorm, if there's a forest fire nearby, you're always inhaling these nanoparticles. That's a potential danger, right? But we don't really worry about that so much because it's not engineered in the same way. Now, when we come back to the engineering side, making nanoparticles, making nanomaterials, the problem is unfortunately even more complex in terms of regulation than one might think originally. And that's because, let's say we decide, based on some of the previous discussion, that it's important to regulate carbon nanotubes. They're a health hazard. We understand that they can cause mesothelioma-like symptoms because of this, what's called the aspect ratio, this length to diameter ratio. But not all nanotubes are made in the same way, even if they are identical. Sometimes we grow them in bulk. We use a special oven. We make many grams of this material. It's free to the atmosphere. You can breathe it. You can do all sorts of things. Other times, we grow individual nanotubes on a silicon chip as part of an integrated electronic device. And so as a researcher, but also just from a common sense standpoint, the kind of danger, the kind of toxicology threat associated with making many grams or kilograms of carbon nanotubes in bulk that you can breathe in is totally different than what you get when you grow it on a silicon chip. It adheres to the chip. It effectively can't come off. And even if it did come off, it would be in some solution where it sticks to everything else. That makes a huge challenge because it's the same material and it's even in the same nanoform. And so how do you address that? I wish I had an answer.
And Tim, just to go in a slightly different direction, you were telling me about the Blue Man.
Blue Man.
Explain the Blue Man to the audience. You'll find this quite revolting, ladies and gentlemen.
And I'm sure some of you have seen this on YouTube. His name is Paul Carson. He's from the US. And he believes that, building on this theme, that nano silver is antibacterial and therefore a healthy product. He ingests, he makes his own silver colloid and he drinks it every day. And he's done it for several years. Now, he's taken up so much particulate silver that all his skin and organs have turned blue. And it's a sort of a grey cornflower blue. It's not very pleasant, actually. He's a redhead, too, so it looks quite odd. it's not killed him yet, but it can't be good for him, is my feeling.
Liria, if we can come back to the whole question of regulation. Does the legal society and the government authorities, are they able to keep up with nanotechnology? Because it's really leaping ahead at such an incredible rate.
It's a common idea about where the law keeps up with technology, and I've actually written a fair bit about what that does or cannot mean. Certainly, technology moves forward. If you try to make laws around technological concepts, though, you have to be very careful. So let me give you an example completely away from nanotechnology. The first digital copying, when that issue first came up, they passed a whole law in the US to try to stop digital copying. And it was all designed around digital tapes. And they had a special tax when you bought digital tapes, and the whole scheme was set up. Of course, now when we think about digital copying, no one is using digital tapes, and the entire law is irrelevant. So in that sense, law will always fall behind technology. If you try to keep up with the latest thing, and say, oh, we've got digital tapes, now let's have the law of digital tapes. That's going to become obsolete before the end of the year. Similarly, if you think about trying to craft the definition of nanotechnology now and say, let's design a law around the risks we perceive today for nanotechnology and a nanotechnology law, and you try to do that, it will become obsolete in the same kind of way. We've got to think about our laws in a different way. So what we have to do is think about, okay, let's take workplace regulation. How do we want to regulate workplaces? That is both how we regulate known risks. So when we know there's a risk, as we do in some areas of nanotechnology, but also a lot of areas that have nothing to do with nanotechnology, what types of rules do we put in place? How do we deal with unknown known risks? In other words, we don't know exactly what the risk is. We can't say we know it's risky. So how do we regulate where we know that there might be a risk, but we don't know how big it is? You know, do we do something like what Europe does, which is more of a precautionary principle? You know, which direction do we go? And that's a social question. We can fix the laws, if you like, to deal with the problems I talked about earlier. So we can think about, okay, where we've been talking about having a ton, you know, you need a ton of the material before we step in, or wherever the thresholds are, and they're in everywhere. I mean, that these sort of thresholds exist in industrial chemical regulation, workplace regulation, I mean, pesticide regulation, all over the place. Where we have those thresholds, perhaps we need to rethink how they're described. So maybe we have to have volume thresholds, but also things like surface area thresholds, so that where nanomaterials become more reactive in smaller quantities, it's often because they have a higher surface area. So we can think about how we express thresholds so that they cover some of the nanotechnology risks at smaller levels. We also need to think about things like the idea of particle size being a variable, which wasn't recognised before. But particle size also shouldn't become the only variable. But if you do what a lot of countries are doing, you look at where the movement is in nanotechnology regulation, they start out with a definition. Typically, one dimension of the material is between 1 and 100 nanometers. So you're regulating a specific range, whereas, in fact, if you look at chemicals that may cause problems, you know, so if it's 100 nanometers, it's regulated, 101 nanometers, it's not. That doesn't actually make any sense when you look at these things in practice. So we have to think about it as a variable, but try to avoid doing what a lot of countries are doing or are proposing to do, which is to make it the primary variable with a separate regulatory scheme just based on that variable.
Paul, just following up on Liria's volume argument, one aspect that's really difficult is safe levels of anything. Tim mentioned the silver nanoparticles. Now, at some level, silver nanoparticles are good for you in what they do, but if you take them to excess, it causes another problem. Tim's story reminded me of one I heard 20-odd years ago in the UK, where a guy in the UK loved bananas and he only ate bananas, and it killed him. After 15 years, he died. He went absolutely yellow and died. Now, we know bananas are not dangerous, but they are dangerous at some level. So setting that level is really difficult for legislators, and I think that's important.
There's another part of this argument that we haven't really touched on. What we haven't considered are the unintended consequences, and in particular, their influence on innovation, something that's very strong in Australia. It's a big reason I came here. At the University of Sydney, we have a new institute, the Australian Institute of Nanoscience, funded by the Department of Innovation. The point being, nothing that we do in this Australian Institute of Nanoscience has anything to do with consumer products, with bulk generation of nanoparticles, with carbon nanotubes, nothing. It involves optics, it involves studies of quantum physics, it involves studies of medical diagnostic techniques and electronic devices. If one said in particular we need to regulate nanoparticles or nanotechnology, and we need to regulate based on, for instance, how often one is exposed to nanomaterials, that could in principle kill a whole generation of scientists. It could absolutely stifle our ability to do research, and I'm not trying to be self-serving in saying that there are no threats, but the threats are specialized. You can have a threat associated with exposure to bulk airborne nanoparticles that's very different from exposure to a microprocessor, right? It's just a different game.
There's been a lot of scaremongering around nanotechnology. A lot of it's come from Prince Charles and arguments about grey goo. Who can explain what grey goo is and why that really shouldn't worry anybody?
I'll take a stab at this.
Off you go, Mike.
It's a horribly unfortunate thing that's happened to the field. Michael Crichton wrote a book called Prey. My understanding is there were some other references to this as well. The idea in Prey was that one created some scientist somewhere. I have not read the book because I'm kind of politically opposed to it. Someone developed a self-replicating nanomachine. The picture you should have in mind is a little tiny robot that's really, really small. That machine builds other machines like itself. It takes over the world. We all die. That's
Crichton's
kind of
such a happy novelist, really, isn't he?
It's Michael Crichton, right? He's pretty anti-science. This is nonsense for lots of physical reasons, but it's stuck in the kind of public conception because it's a really alarming picture. I mean, I personally do not want to be devoured by nanomachines. That's a very unappealing prospect. It's just not physically realistic, and it has nothing to do with what nanotechnology, nanoscience, nanomaterials actually are. So how do we fight that perception?
Mike Biersick from the Quantum Control Centre at the University of Sydney. You're listening to our Big Ideas Summer of Science on ABC Radio National, and we're delving into the shopping trolley to discover the tiny world of nanotechnology. The other speakers on our Cafe Scientific panel are Jim Williams and Tim Senden from the ANU and Liria Bennett-Moses from the Faculty of Law at the University of Sydney. Our host, Paul Willis, is taking questions from the audience, and this one is directed to Mike Biersick.
Mike, you rubbished the idea that we should have regulations based on scale, But you also said that at the very small scale, particles behave differently. Is that a reason why we should have special regulations?
All right, I'm happy to address that. So I want to make clear, I didn't make fun of the idea of regulations based on size scale. I made fun of the concept that nanotechnology is one thing. It is not one thing. It's many different things. The point I was simply trying to make is that a one-size-fits-all approach to regulation does not make sense. Your comment is absolutely correct, and it's been echoed by many different people on this panel in different parts of the discussion, that when you change the size scale of a chemical compound, a nanomaterial, for instance, lots of physical principles, physical properties change. They can range from the way they reflect light, as we've talked about in sunscreen, to the electronic properties, to the fact that in some of these zinc oxide nanoparticles in particular, when you have a very large surface area to volume ratio, you can end up having photoexcited free radicals. We all hear about free radicals. Free radicals are bad. You want skin creams that get rid of free radicals. These nanoparticles can, in principle, generate them. It's something to be concerned about. So I'm not trying to downplay the notion that size comes into play. I'm trying to downplay the notion that size is the only thing that matters.
And your second question?
This might be really complicated, but could you try and explain a bit about why particles behave differently at the very small scale? And are those changes predictable?
Could I have a go at that one?
Jim, it's your question.
Following on from what Mike just said, they're very different properties that you tend to look at for nanoparticles. If you look at chemical reactivity, for example, many chemical reactions, most are enhanced on surfaces. And small particles have a lot of surface area, but not much inside them. That's what a nanoparticle actually is. If you look at that concept, that if you take a nanoparticle, depending on how small it is, there are roughly as many atoms on the surface as there are in the middle of it. And that changes a whole range of physical properties. The ability to absorb light, the ability to conduct electricity, the ability to have chemical reactions take place, all of these things, the strength of particles. A long time ago, it was found that if you made the internal structure of a material very small, that is the little crystal sizes that all pack together, you could make that material much stronger. In the samurai swords, they used to pee on their swords. That was to introduce nitrogen in them, but also to quench the metal into very small nanocrystals. They didn't know what they were doing at that stage, but that's what it did.
You could see it creeping into the ceremony, though, couldn't you?
That's right.
Time for a pee, right?
Yeah, that's right. So they didn't know what they were doing, but the nanoparticles are stronger. So there's a whole range of properties that change when particles are smaller, and it's because of the relationship, small number of atoms that are there, large surface areas, and surfaces sticking together if you're putting those particles together.
So there's more to that. There are many practical aspects associated with surface areas and things like this. But then there's also things, and I'll get a little esoteric for a second, relating to quantum mechanics. Part of the question that I wanted to address is, can we predict these properties? Now, as a scientist, I'll say we can never predict everything, right? But quantum mechanics is a really useful framework. It tells us about the behavior of single particles like electrons, single atoms, single photons of light, things at very small size scales. This framework is extremely useful. It's extremely accurate, and you can argue it's the most accurate theory in the world. And nanotechnology is starting to see effects of these quantum mechanical properties, because everything is getting so small, and people may have heard generally this notion that quantum mechanics says light and electrons, light and matter, it's a particle and it's a wave at the same time. Let's not get too deep into that, but let's just say, okay, it's a wave sometimes. When the wavelength of that thing you're caring about, an electron, for instance, is about the same size as the particle in which it lives, the physics changes, right? It's just a matter of size scales. These are things we can predict, and we do this kind of on a daily basis.
Okay, I have a question back here.
I'm interested in the environmental regulations of nanoparticles. There was an article in New Scientist recently on nanosilver and its interaction with microorganisms in the greater environment, in which they found that obviously it suppressed the microorganisms' ability to digest organic material, but as a consequence it released four times as much nitrogen oxide as the unaffected microorganisms. Do we have any other information about these environmental impacts of nanoparticles in the environment?
Tim?
Well, thank you for that question. I just recently became aware of this myself. I was asking a senior scientist, Neville Fletcher, in fact, who's done seeding of rain clouds for many years, and there have been studies in Tasmania where they've used basically a smoke of silver iodide, which eventually photoconverts to silver metal very quickly and scatters itself as nanoparticles of silver through the environment. And they have found exactly, as you said, very articulately spoken, that there is a suppression of certain microorganisms and an increase of others, and the consequences and imbalance that leads to, in fact, some quite potent greenhouse gases, amongst other things. So, yes, we do have to be careful about the way these particles are spread through the environment. There's no doubt of that. I guess what my colleagues and I are suggesting is that when one tries to regulate these things, you look at them at one level as their chemical entity, but then look at their fate, and that's often something that's quite hard to determine up front on a lab scale. So there should be great care in how these materials are spread through the environment. There's in a dispersed form, I think that's quite the case. Mike's point about them being incorporated in devices and made and rendered safe is a very good one, and I think that we shouldn't lose track of that, because many applications of nanotechnology are rendered safe both in a recycling sense and an environmental sense because they become permanently incorporated and trained into other materials.
I'd like to add to that as well, if that's all right. Something that we always have to keep in mind when we worry about environmental hazards for anything in particular is, what is the scale of production of this potential hazard? If you think about nanoparticles that are being produced specifically to produce nanoparticles. I want to produce carbon nanotubes for application X. Most organizations struggle to make kilograms per day. Compare that to the amount of nanoparticulate soot that comes out of internal combustion engines when you add up all the coal-fired plants or the motor vehicles pertaining to internal combustion. You know, we're just talking about extremely different size scales. Now, again, that's not to say we shouldn't worry about this, but I personally think there are lots of other things we can worry about first.
I'll just jump in there too and add that in the case of diesel smoke, it's a vehicle. It's taking the toxic chemicals to your lungs. It's not toxic itself. And just the hazard of breathing in diesel fumes alone is already a large chemical hazard. So, yeah, I take Mike's point very well.
I think one aspect that comes out of this in terms of this regulation is the scale that we mentioned, but also nanotechnology has now raised the level of what is safe in a whole range of areas. And the silver iodide seeding of clouds that Tim talked about for inducing rain, that's been done for so many years, well before nanotechnology was prevalent, yet it's causing a nano problem in the environment. So I think this general raising of our awareness to what might be safe and not safe that's come out of nano is good.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Nanotechnology, extremely small particles, but extremely large issues that are going to affect us all, and they're already affecting each and every one of us. It's been a fascinating discussion. Please, could you put your hands together for our four wonderful panellists? Mike Pearcey, Jim Williams, Lyria Bennett-Moses, and Tim Sendon.
ABC TV's Paul Willis hosted this Cafe Scientific event, which was produced by Abby Thomas. Panellists were Dr. Mike Biersick from the Quantum Control Laboratory at the University of Sydney, Professor Jim Williams and Professor Tim Sendon from the School of Physics and Engineering at the Australian National University, and Dr. Lyria Bennett-Moses from the Faculty of Law at the University of Sydney. Thanks to sound engineer Lila Schooner, and I'm Lynn Malcolm. Don't forget you can download the audio of the show from our website, abc.net.au/rn, and click on Big Ideas in the program list. And I hope you can join me next week for our Big Ideas Summer of Science, when we explore our gloriously messy universe with Professor Marcelo Gleiser and a panel at the Brisbane Writers' Festival. Catch you next week. Bye for now.